Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Last week, we did part one on the Ed Sullivan shows and the Beatles' appearance on the Ed Sullivan show. And it was a quite meandering path to get us to the day itself when the band were due to appear on the show, which went out on the 9th of February, 1964. So today, we're going to start from their arrival in New York and trace their relationship with Ed Sullivan over the subsequent years. As we said last week, they land on the 7th of February, and something we kind of glossed over was the JFK press conference, which is something that, you know, when you think of the Beatles getting to America, is a really, really pertinent moment. It's really iconic.
Yes. I mean, this is, I suppose, their first live appearance on American television.
That is the true live appearance. Yeah.
You know, that's the true live appearance. And, given the fact that they've been used to this kind of press conference or this kind of interview in the UK, you imagine they must have been petrified, but they don't look petrified. They don't look nervous. They look incredibly relaxed. Yes. I mean, they know they're performing, and it's quite a performance.
It is, and it was colorized for the Ron Howard film, colorized quite badly, I thought. But they are supremely confident, and as you say, if they're nervous, they don't show it. But it's the press conference where the press just clamoring over them, and they're not singing. You know, but they are doing a performance, and it's all part of priming the pump for Sullivan. So it's all like, well, you sing a song, well, you'll have to pay us first.
Yeah.
You know, why is it so successful if we knew we'd form a group and be managers? All that stuff, which you assume is coming off the top of their heads, is happening in real life.
Yes. I mean, again, if this were happening today or at any point after the Beatles had done that first press conference, these would be scripted answers.
Yeah.
And some PR guy would have been saying, this is, if they ask you this, then say this. If they ask you this, then say that. But clearly, they're not good enough actors to pull that off. I mean, this is clearly a spontaneous set of responses. And it's fantastic. And the absolute star of the show for me there is Ringo.
Ringo is totally happy. Like, he's really happy. And we talk about this, you know, how true are these kind of codified personalities of the Beatles? But, you know, John is definitely being a bit sarcastic. Ringo is definitely being the Beatles fan in the room. And, Paul and George are just having a hoot as well. And it's charismatic, and it is genuinely funny. They are genuinely making that room laugh.
Yes, yes. I mean, the press are there, you imagine, because of the screaming fans, because of the Beatlemania phenomenon that they've been reading about. They have no experience of this band other than these are some long-haired guys from England that have this kind of hysteria going on in England. What are they going to be like? And they absolutely charm the press.
Absolutely.
Because that press conference could have gone really badly.
Yes.
You know,
it could have been very confrontational.
You're kind of thinking if Lennon had switched on to full kind of sarcastic mode, and just it could have been very combative and very it could have been a train wreck.
Well, you know, it's funny how, you know, the press conference becomes a staple of Beatle appearances, you know, well into 66, you know, and by the 66 press conferences, they are combative and they are kind of surly and rude. And you're like, what benefit is there of them doing a press conference in 1966? How many more tickets is that going to sell particularly? Yeah. But back then, you know, it's another one of these happy accidents, happy lineups that they are in good form. The press are in good form. They are number one. But it's also mindful that the Ed Sullivan show, when it goes out two nights later, isn't getting high ratings because it's the Ed Sullivan show. It's because of all this stuff that is happening in the run up to February the 9th.
That's it. It's all building up. The news reports, the single taking off, but also this press conference. And again, it's perhaps difficult to overstate the impact of that press conference.
Yeah. So that's February the 7th. They go off to the Plaza Hotel, and February the 8th is due to be the day before the show, and it's due to be rehearsal day. What could possibly go wrong? Well, George's throat goes wrong.
George's throat goes wrong. George's throat goes wrong all the way from here up to 1974. You know, this is a recurring.
And he doesn't get his tonsils out. He spends 2 weeks in hospitals in 69 getting his tonsils out. Yeah. So he's waiting a long time to get his tonsils out. Yeah. Also, yeah. You wouldn't get 2 weeks in hospital these days for getting your tonsils out, I'll tell you.
He didn't have time to get his tonsils out before 1969. That's the problem.
Yeah, I know. And have those tonsils come up for auction, I wonder? Who knows?
Some doctor somewhere has those. You know what doctors are like.
And on a wall.
Yeah.
But George does have a sore throat because their first kind of public activity on the morning of the 8th of February before rehearsal is a photo shoot out in Central Park. And again, these are kind of famous, iconic photos, but you look at them and it is just John, Paul and Ringo. George is not there.
And I mean, again, you must I imagine what that was like. You know, you get there, you've got a number one single, everything's going fantastically well, and then suddenly, your lead guitar player is laid low. And his sister talks about this.
So his sister, we need reminding, lives in North America, and George had visited her in 1963 and had spent a brief time in New York in 63 as part of his visit to her. And she comes up to New York to be with George for this appearance.
Yes, that's right. So Louise Harrison, or Louise Caldwell, as she was, and she talks about this, and she said he had a temperature of 104. They were pumping him full of drugs. They were going to get a nurse to come and kind of sit with him. And she says, you know, the doctor then realized that she was there. She was his sister, and she was tasked with this sort of looking after him. But, he made a joke about, you're the only female in New York that can function normally. But it all rests on her getting him well enough to get. And they clearly take this very seriously, because he just doesn't leave the room, I think, for any of the promotional activities that are going on.
It's all eyes are on the show. The show is the important thing. And it's a bit like Pink Floyd's Comfortably Numb. You know, she is administering the medicines to try and get him ready so he can do the show.
But let's stress that administering everything legally.
Legal
medicine is legal medicine.
So meanwhile, John, Paul and Ringo are out wandering around Central Park within sight of the Dakota Building, which is, interesting foreshadowing. And, they're getting their photo taken. There's another press conference in the morning. This kind of split between John, Paul, Ringo and George, this leads into the legend of the Rickenbacker, doesn't it?
Yes, this is an interesting story. So George is alone, or is alone of the four in the hotel, and the couple of stories about how George gets his Rickenbacker 12 string guitar. And the best one is that the president of the company shows up with the guitar, intending to give the guitar to John. Of course, John isn't there. George is there, and he nabs the guitar for himself, which is a good story. But in 2017, there was an article in Guitar World that sort of gives a little bit more background. And what they say is that Francis C. Hall, who was the president of Rickenbacker, which is a California-based company, he had actually spoken to Epstein before they arrived in the US and arranged a meeting with the group. So again, there's this idea that, the guys at Rickenbacker can see what's happening, what way the wind is blowing, and they've set this up. He arrives at the Savoy Hilton in New York, and he shows the band several different models. Lennon tries out the 12 string, but he thinks, no, this would actually be more suitable for George, who is still back at the Plaza. And he gets it that way. So it's not that he stole the guitar from John. And it was only the second Rickenbacker 12 string ever made.
I know. And it goes on to cast a long shadow and play a big part. You know, George loves the guitar, doesn't he?
He absolutely falls in love with this. He said, I'm not a guitar person, but he says it's to do with the fact that it's much more easily tuned than any 12 string he'd ever had before. And if you think about how influential that becomes across Hard Day's Night, Help, Ticket to Ride, and even the look of it is it's as iconic as Paul's Hofner bass.
So that afternoon, about lunchtime, the Beatles, without George, go by limousine just a few blocks over from the Plaza to Studio 50/the Ed Sullivan Theatre. You know, and it's, you know, it's full on Beatle hysteria, you know, fans on the cars, people going crazy, police officers everywhere, you know, the real deal again, yes. Before they've even appeared on the show. So it's all mounting. And Lord knows what the you know, the Ed Sullivan production staff must have known, that they had a big thing on their hands or a big thing brewing. But it's Neil Aspinall who stands in for George when they spend that afternoon rehearsing.
Yes, yes. So Neil, the road manager, is there, and they have got this all marked out and blocked out. So they need somebody to stand in and hold the guitar. And there's some very sort of funny photographs that just don't look right, because it's the band standing there and suddenly it's Neil standing holding a guitar instead of George.
Well, you're very close to a Jimmy Nicol moment. You know, I can't imagine the stress that Brian must have been feeling about, you know, getting George match fit. You know, we don't really know how close it came to him not making it, but it just really wasn't an option. You know, there was no way you could, like, you kind of think of, you know, geez, if George really hadn't been able to do it, would they have pulled out? Could they have gotten somebody else? It's hard to fathom.
Well, they do have a plan B. There's a production assistant called Vince Calandra, and he talks about this, because at one point he stands in and he said, you know, Ed Sullivan is running around with a Beatle wig. And he's saying, you know, he'd better show up, because if not, I'll be the fourth Beatle. So, yeah, you know,
that might not have worked.
That would have been brilliant.
So they spend the afternoon rehearsing, and, you know, it might seem like an awful lot of rehearsal for a TV show, but I think it makes perfect sense. I know even these days, stuff like Later with Jules Holland has a full day blocked of rehearsals before they put the show on air. But you see the camera moves, that stuff's not being spontaneously done.
No, they have this all kind of blocked out. And Ringo tells a story and said, you know, we did all that. We had chalk marks on the floor where we were going to stand. And then, you know, we left, and then a cleaner came in and wiped all the chalk mark off the floor.
Yes.
Supposedly.
And there was also, you know, the question of trying to manipulate the sound equipment, wasn't there, to try and get a decent sound as well.
Yes, Ringo is in Anthology is pretty scathing about that, and saying, you know, it was really bad sound equipment and it was all very hastily done, and he's not impressed in Anthology with the sound. And if you watch the shows, the thing that strikes me is there's a lot of background sound.
Yeah, you can hear the show happening, getting ready, setting up between bits and pieces.
Exactly. So when Sullivan's talking, you can hear people moving the set around, and when other acts are on and doing singing and dancing, as they move around the set, you can hear the kind of clump, clump, clump of their feet on the, it's really badly mic'd.
Yeah. But February the 9th is D-Day, the day of the broadcast. And up in the morning, there's another group of rehearsals ready. George is still ill. And so Neil Aspinall is still the George stand-in for camera blocking and camera shots. And hopefully, you know, George's sister Louise is really working hard to get George ready. But they do one last round of preparations, and cometh the hour, George is ready. But it is worth keeping in mind that, you know, when the show goes live on that Sunday evening, February the 9th at 8 o'clock, you know, John, Paul and Ringo all know the layout, the set out, they know what's going to happen. But George is kind of floating into this essentially for the first time. He has not rehearsed at all.
No, he's not been in the studio before. He's not been a party to this at all. So, he's got to just stand there and follow the cues.
Yeah. So, you know, the actual show itself, there might not be much that we need to say. It's become a milestone in American popular culture. It set off the British invasion, so to speak. The statistics are that it went out live from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. As I said, it was a Sunday night. Inside the studio itself, there was just 728 people, but apparently 50,000 requested a ticket for the show, which is nice. And the number that was given was that it had 73.7 million viewers across 2 million homes in the United States. At that time, the biggest viewing figures for any television show in American history. And, you know, it's become quite iconic. And the show has two appearances by the Beatles at the top and tail of the show. And at the start of the show, Sullivan comes out and he opens with the famous telegram, doesn't he?
Yes. Yeah, so he announces that Elvis Presley and his manager, Colonel Tom Parker, have sent a telegram saying, "Congratulations on your appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show and your visit to America. We hope your engagement will be a successful one and your visit pleasant. Give our best, Mr. Sullivan. Sincerely, Elvis and the Colonel."
So within those few weeks, the Beatles are on the consciousness of Elvis. They must. You wonder what the purpose of that was. Was it to get a bit of publicity off the back of the Beatles? Was it to were they fearing for their future?
I think this is just to remind everyone that you know, regardless of these English guys, don't forget it's Elvis and the Colonel. And of course, the irony is Elvis knew nothing about this. This is just the Colonel telegram. I think this is just you know, as you say, him trying to keep Elvis front and center. Don't be distracted by this. Sullivan had given the Beatles the telegram before the show, to which George said, "Elvis who?"
So, yeah.
You know, good old George.
Good old George. They are at the height of their powers. So, you know, Sullivan famously introduces them. The audience goes wild. And of course, they kick off into "All My Lovin'."
Yes.
Which I'm assuming everybody listening to this has seen the Beatles do "All My Lovin'" on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah, you would think so.
And you know, to you know, it is iconic. To paraphrase Dave Letterman many years later, you know, they are performing in the midst of free floating geometric shapes. But you can see how all that blocking works in terms of camera angles, the camera swooping up towards Ringo. And what I've noticed years later is because these shows came out on VHS and DVD, and they came out as complete shows, is that when you watch the shows as complete episodes, the Beatles do seem like they have just landed from space. I don't know whether that's my own, my own feelings, because I just like the Beatles so much and I'm glad to see them. But you watch them in the context of the show and it's really strong what they're doing.
You can understand. No, I absolutely agree with you. I watched them all again ahead of this, and you're absolutely right. I mean, it's like they've perhaps not landed from another planet, but landed from another time.
Yeah.
You know, they are surrounded by magicians doing card tricks and weird puppet shows and very bad comedy routines and dancers, and suddenly you've got this rock and roll group and they're playing live.
Yep.
And they're having a ball, and you can understand why they just stand out compared with everything. It's like, okay, all of this is old. All of this is in the past, and we're here and we are the future. It's incredibly striking.
And they start with the song "All My Loving," which, you know, let's just take a second to think, that's not a single, that's an album track. And it's an album track that wouldn't be known in America yet. So they're opening with this unknown song that they wrote themselves. And it is the perfect choice.
It is the perfect choice, but it's also, a kind of difficult, you know, a difficult song to play live, in the sense that it's very precise. You know, it's got those very kind of stop start sections to it, and it's a perfect performance. It's a kind of slap in the face. You know, it really wakes you up.
Considering everything that had happened in the run up, you know, because out of all their performances, it's the first show that's the most important. And out of all the bits in the first show, it's the first song that's the most important. And considering the road they took to get there, including George being sick and everything else. And as you say, it's a song that is slightly tricky. It doesn't have an intro, for instance. It starts with, you know, just a clear vocal. The fact that that's the song out of all the five songs they performed that night that needs to matter, that lands so perfectly. And George, who, you know, hadn't rehearsed, he nails that solo. In fact, George, you know, we've talked about this before amongst ourselves, is what's striking about that first performance is John is, his mic is down. It's very much a Paul performance. And, you know, George does his solo to camera as if he's the coolest guy in the world.
Yeah.
Ringo is on his riser. John is a little bit missing or mixed down. I know he seems to have mic issues.
Yeah, it's funny the way it's staged, because they're not lined up sort of equally across the stage. John's mic is actually quite further forward, but in the camera angle, then they look more together. But if you look at the screen time that they get, it's all about Paul.
Yeah.
Then George, and then John and Ringo sort of get equal mic time. And John is very much the third man. In this show, and it does one. I do sometimes wonder: is George so relaxed because he didn't have a rehearsal?
Yes,
because he isn't as conscious of having to stand here or do these particular moves, or is he just pumped full of drugs? I don't know.
Well, I think he's also, you know, he there's a certain novelty to George because he's doing it for the first time as well. But yeah. it goes to show how well rehearsed and how tight they are.
And George sort of moves between the two microphones. You know, he doesn't have a mic of his own. So he's moving between Paul's mic and John's mic. And it works perfect for someone that hasn't rehearsed the camera blocking.
Yeah.
He's completely there. You know, he's completely across it.
So for the first part of the show, they do three songs, All My Loving, Till There Was You, and She Loves You. It's kind of, it's not the same songs as the Royal Variety Performance, but it's kind of the same type of energy as the Royal Variety Performance. And it's, you know, I always find for both, you know, the Royal Variety Performance and Ed Sullivan, Till There Was You is just one of those choices. You're like, really? But, you know, they still believed at that point, the Beatles, in showing their versatility. And Till There Was You is also very much a Paul and George highlight. George nailing that really tricky solo and Paul doing his doe-eyed, you know, silver bells, whatever voice.
Yes. And it's you know, it's a song that the mums and dads will know.
Well, you know, after the punch in the face of All My Lovin', you know, the mums and dads like, what, you know, what is this? You know, Till There Was You is pretty easy to understand.
I think it's very clever.
Yeah.
Because, and in the same way that the Royal Variety Show performance was clever, because they're explaining to the mums and dads almost, you know, and they don't open with She Loves You, or they don't open with I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yeah,
they open with All My Loving is a kind of great song. It's just a great song. Then they hit the mums and dads with, you know, don't be too concerned. You know, we're nice boys, and we're not threatening. And here's a show tune. Here's a song everyone will know. And then they go into She Loves You.
She Loves You. And it's during Till There Was You that the famous captions come up, you know, how he, you know, here's Paul, here's George, here's Ringo, here's John. Sorry, girls, he's married.
Yeah. I mean, you can kind of, it's so cheesy.
Yes.
So cheesy.
And then they do She Loves You. And then that's the end of their first bunch of songs. The crowd goes wild, and Ed Sullivan needs to tell everyone to just calm down. Will you all
Because now we've got musicians and Tessie O'Shea and the cast from Oliver, and, you know.
Well, the next person up is a guy called Fred Capps, and you got to feel sorry for Fred Capps, who was the act on after the Beatles. He was a pre-recorded so that they could change the set around for the Oliver performance. And he's a magician who did not go down well because nobody really was paying any attention. Everyone was just recovering.
Yeah.
And he's actually a famous magician. His floating cork trick is a famous trick. He was a guest on Parkinson in the 70s. He was a, you know, bit of a legend, but he kind of, you know, you go Google him now and he's like the poor sod who had to follow the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, you know.
But he's doing card tricks. You know, this thing where there's salt endlessly pouring out of his hand. I mean, it
would have been good in its time, but it's odd how 73 million viewers doesn't necessarily change the fortunes of Fred Capps for the rest of his days.
No, certainly not.
And
well, Sullivan, we're still talking about him.
This is true.
Fame.
This isn't the Fred Capps podcast, I'm afraid. And, you know, the audience are a bit unruly. Ed Sullivan says at one point, if you don't keep quiet, I'm going to send for a barber. Hilarious. But the other fun fact of that show was that Davy Jones from the Monkees is on that show.
Yes, I watched the whole show just to see Davy Jones.
So at that time, Davy Jones was a teenage star who was appearing on Broadway in Lionel Bart's Oliver, playing the Artful Dodger, which he transferred from London to New York. The other side point, the person who filled his role back in London, Phil Collins.
Well,
as a teenage star. There you go.
Let's tell the Phil Collins story.
All roads lead back to Phil Collins. But yeah, you watch this show, and apart from, you know, when you watch it in 21st century, apart from the Beatles seeming like they're from space, you're like, hey, there's Davy Jones from the Monkees appearing on the same show as the Beatles. That's weird.
He does talk about the fact that he witnessed the kind of hysteria.
Yeah. and said, I want a bit of that.
And thought, I want a bit of that. You know. I want some of that. So, artful dodger.
Yeah. So there's lots of inbuilt advertisements for Anacin, which is Anadin, and
is that a ripoff to avoid being sued by Anadin?
No, I just think it's one of these. It's just one of the. It's the same company. I think it's all Bayer Pharmaceuticals. It's just the American.
They should have got George. Should have got George to. I'm hopped up on Anacin.
Yes. If you're like me, kids, Georgia Brown, Tessie O'Shea, Frank Worsham, these are the other guests. But then at the end of the show, the Beatles come out and they do two more songs, which are I Saw Her Standing There and then the number one hit on the land, I Want to Hold Your Hand. Because I Saw Her Standing There is the B-side in the US, isn't it? Too? I Want to Hold Your Hand. Yes. So they did the B-side and the A-side and they end with I Want to Hold Your Hand. But almost when you're watching the show, it's not that the damage has been done, but all the stuff that has happened right at the start. You know, they've already won when they come back at the end of the show.
Absolutely. They must be standing in the wings or sitting in the dressing room thinking, you know, we've done it. That's it. You know, we've arrived.
But you never get a sense from them that they were worried about, oh, are we going to do it? They were just like, you know, they've always, and they've spoken about this in interviews since, that their supreme self-confidence of, well, you know, if we get to go to Ed Sullivan, of course we're going to ace it. You know, that was kind of the take on it, you know, so that, you know, Brian does his part of the deal to get them there and they'll do their part of the deal to just knock it out of the park.
Yeah, but you think if somebody picked up the phone to you and me and said, look, in 2 months' time, we want you to go on the Stephen Colbert show and there's going to be 73 million people watching you.
I'm ready.
Be up for that. There's no sign of nerves at all. The performance of I Saw Her Standing There and I Want to Hold Your Hand, a little bit more kind of looser, I think, than what's going on in the first half.
Yeah.
And I think that just must reflect the fact that they kind of realize, you know,
everything's changed. And after the show, Murray the K takes John Paul and Ringo to the Playboy Club and then onto the Peppermint Lounge. So obviously George went back to recover some more. He's still not well. And they danced the twist until 4 a.m. But it's almost immediately, though, that the legend kicks in, the legend of the Ed Sullivan shows, you know.
Yes.
And so, you know, Paul in the anthology says, you know, one of the largest viewings ever seen in the States. You know, we came out of nowhere with funny hair. Well, that's not true. They weren't out of nowhere. They were the number one act in the land.
Yes,
been on a couple of TV shows already. You know, the hairdo broke us more than the music. I don't think so. A lot of fathers turned it off, but a lot of mothers and children made us keep it on. Now all those children are grown up and they're telling us they remember it. Like, where were you when Kennedy was shot? I meet people like Dan Aykroyd saying, I remember that Sunday night, we didn't know what had hit us. Suddenly, the Beatles. And again, this is all legend building because, you know, as we said before, Ed Sullivan had, you know, Elvis on, he'd had Bo Diddley on, he'd had Bill Haley on, you know, stuff wasn't, it's not like there was zero. And you had also the whole, you know, Dick Clark enterprise, you know, there was rock and roll on American television. It just, some of it wasn't very good.
Some of it wasn't very good. But Sullivan in particular, you know, was breaking these acts. I mean, he had rock and roll on before. So I think that's Paul. I think this is the point we touched on last week, which is this idea that the Beatles themselves sort of, they remember the legend rather than what actually happened, perhaps, you know?
One big legend is that the crime rate fell while the Beatles were on. So it's 1 hour of television. It's 73 million viewers, 8 to 9 p.m. And something that's endlessly repeated is that there was no crime committed in America. And the Beatles even say this themselves. And I know I can rely on you, Stephen, to tell me that that's a total
untruth. It's not true. There were hubcaps stolen in New York. Where this comes from is a chap called B.F. Henry, who was the editor, news editor at the Washington Post. And he quipped that, you know, during the hour that they were on Ed Sullivan, there wasn't a hubcap stolen in America. And this has become, oh, isn't this marvelous? The Beatles united everybody. But that's not what he was intending by that. Yeah. He was basically saying all the hoodlums, all the delinquents who would otherwise be out stealing hubcaps were sitting in front of the TV watching the Beatles. So it was put down, kind of reflecting that idea that adults had that, you know, that the Beatles were appealing to the unsavory side of American youth. And then one of his columnists repeated it in the Washington Post. Build Gold. Then it was picked up by Newsweek, and this became the legend. But actually, Gold, in a follow-up, sort of made a spoof out of it, and he said, well, it's with a heavy heart that I must inform Newsweek that the report was not true, and that Mr. Lawrence Fellance of 307 East Graveson Street, Alexandria, had his car parked on church property during that hour, and all four of his hubcaps were stolen. We regret that somewhere in Alexandria there lives a hipster who is too poor to own a TV set. So, you know, it's all intended to be a put down.
Yeah, it's a joke that got out of hand.
It's a joke that's got out of hand. And it's a joke that has become taken as a compliment, that it somehow united everyone, and kind of peace and love. And, you know, George tells this story as a fact. Yeah. And in America, there was no crime.
Yeah. You know? And if you do take a step back and you think about it, and you're like, nobody was reporting crime figures by the hour in 1964. So it's a load of hooey. There, I've said it.
Oh, you've got to print the legend.
It's a total print the legend moment. But it was obvious the next day, Monday, the 10th of February, that the Beatles were, the kings of the world. But don't forget, the Beatles had signed up for 3 Ed Sullivan shows on the 9th and on the 16th, and the decision was made that there would also be an appearance on the 23rd. And so there is a week of activity to get them from New York, the Ed Sullivan show in New York on the 9th of February, to the following week's show, which was a remote show that was coming from Florida, Miami, Florida, on Sunday, February the 16th. And what's interesting is that the Beatles had a very full calendar on the week in between. So, you know, briefly to go through that, they take a train down to Washington and they do a big concert in Washington, D.C. that's filmed for broadcast a few days later on an internal circuit. And we still have that film. It's quite fascinating to see them play the Washington Coliseum on Tuesday, the 11th of February.
Yes, this is the show where Ringo is sort of in the middle of the stage, and they have to the
every couple of songs,
they're completely surrounded by the audience, so they have to kind of stop and turn the drum kit so that you get each segment of the audience gets to see Ringo for 2 songs or 3 songs.
It's very striking, and you see Neil and Mal kind of running on stage to help move the drum riser around. It's very cool. Then they travel back to New York on Wednesday, the 12th of February, for a show in Carnegie Hall. That's a small audience of 2,000 to 3,000.
Yeah.
Sid Bernstein promotes that, who, you know, we could do a whole episode on Sid Bernstein.
There's a whole episode on the Sid Bernstein connection.
Yeah. And that's on Wednesday, the 12th of February. And then after that, they fly down to Florida to prep for Ed Sullivan, but also to get some days off.
To get some sun.
So they go to take a break. So we might take a break right here, and we'll be right back to tell you what happens next.
End of part one. Intermission. End of intermission. Part two.
Welcome back. So the Beatles have a tiny micro break in Miami. So the second Ed Sullivan show is due to be on Sunday, the 16th of February, from the Deauville Hotel on Miami Beach. And they fly down to Miami on Thursday, the 13th, for a little bit of R&R. And, you know, they're undoubtedly kings of the world. And the few days they spend in Miami is a bit of Beatledom that I really love, because they are stars. They are so happy. They are seeing, you know, Ringo says, you know, he sees palm trees for the first time, and particularly Ringo, because, you know, you see Ringo now in the, you know, living in LA with, you know, his, you know, loving the sunshine, loving the LA life. It all kind of goes back to, I think, that trip to Miami in 1964.
Yeah. Now he's living in LA with palm trees of his own.
He does have palm trees of his own. And so they are, there's some iconic stuff that happens during those few days in Miami. The pictures of them in the pool for Life magazine, where their heads are sticking out of the pool. And one of those pictures goes off to be the cover of George Harrison's Early Takes Volume 1 album. You know, all that stuff happens on that weekend. And
I mean, it really must have been insane to have, you know, you kind of come from Liverpool.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get, there's this sense that even in 1963, 64, England is black and white and America is technicolor, and it probably doesn't get much more technicolor than Miami. And they're kind of lounging by the pool, and they're the whitest people you've ever seen. They're so pale, and they're kind of wearing these little kind of amusing cut off short toweling.
Yes.
Robe things, and they're the same color as the white robes.
Well, although at the time we're talking now, international travel is a bit of a pipe dream, but certainly back in 1963-64, international travel wasn't particularly common. And no. you kind of think it's one thing for them to go to New York, which is kind of a famous, iconic place that, it still would have been amazing, but there's a certain kind of familiarity if you've seen it in the movies. But to then go down to Miami Beach, to actually, I'm reminded of when I was a kid and you'd get hit by a wall of heat if you went to Spain or somewhere. Like, would they have even had been, experienced just that heat for the first time, on their frames, and to have access to people with private swimming pools, people lending them boats. They had a security detail sailing them all around the harbor. Must have been magic.
This is their thing. They're kind of being fated by the rich and famous in Miami. Isn't there a story where Ringo crashes somebody's boat? They lend him a boat and he drives it into... Nobody minds. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
But because they're experiencing it for the first time, and this is a recurrent theme, they're not jaded of it. They're not cynical about it. And that kind of, as I've said before, that kind of early Beatles, they're still kind of sarcastic, funny types, but they're not cynical about how magic all of this is just yet.
No, they're still doing everything for the first time. Each one of these experiences is a new experience. It hasn't become a treadmill yet.
Yeah. So as we head into the weekend, they do a little bit of promo. They do a telephone interview for Dick Clark's Bandstand, and they're also calling back to the UK. There's some calls there where they're filling in Brian Matthews about what's going on. But the second appearance that they've scheduled to do on the Ed Sullivan Show is, as we said, at the Miami Hotel, the Deauville, where they are staying as well. And this is a very different type of Ed Sullivan Show to the first one. And it's perhaps not obviously quite as iconic or as well remembered. For starters, it's obviously not in the Studio 50 theater. It's in a convention room in a large hotel. So it has an odd vibe once it starts.
Yes, it's a very different feel to the whole thing. And this hotel, the Deauville Hotel, is a relatively new hotel. When they're there, it was built in 1957. It was the Hotel of the Year. I didn't know that was a competition. But it is kind of redolent of that older showbizzy kind of feel, bit I suppose a bit like the hotel, like the Sands in Vegas. It's played host to Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Joan Rivers, Jerry Lewis. Kennedy had given a speech there, and so it is a kind of very established showbiz type thing. And I thought, well, if we do our, once we travel restrictions, we could go to the Deauville Hotel and we could have like an American Nothing Is Real live
fan
episode.
I think that'd be a great idea.
Except I have to sadly have to tell you that it was closed down in 2017 after an electrical fire.
Yeah, I think there's a big movement online to try and save it because it still stands, but only just.
Yeah, well, if they get that back up and running, I think we can say to our fans, if the Deauville Hotel reopens and the petty cash is up to it, we'll hold our 2050 convention in the Deauville Hotel.
Well, that's where the Beatles are based, and they're enjoying every minute of it, and they rehearse on the Saturday and the Sunday for the show itself. It's a slightly different vibe show. Technically, they're not really the headliners. It's Mitzi again.
We're going to have to get. We're going to have to get in touch with Mitzi Gaynor.
Seriously, Mitzi Gaynor, 89, still going strong. A bit of a showbiz legend, which is fantastic. And the show again goes out, at 8 p.m. live and is watched again by 70-odd million people. And they perform some new songs, some old songs. The thing I would say that's quite noticeable when you go and watch the show is Ringo, the state of Ringo in that second show is amusing, to say the least.
You think he's had too much sun?
He's, if you think of Ringo from the first show, he's this big kind of smiling, wobbly headed guy. You watch him on the second show, his playing, there's nothing to complain about, but he looks ferociously hungover and tired and
it's maybe sun, a little Jason. Bit.
Yeah, okay,
It's the sun. He's had a little bit too much sun and possibly a little bit too much of everything.
Perhaps. Yes, he's more heavy lidded than normal. They perform six songs on that second show. They open with the first part, She Loves You, This Boy, and All My Lovin' Again. What I would say is, you know, we talked about how in the first episode that the first Sullivan show they did, John is a little bit in the back seat. But oh my goodness, that performance of This Boy, Lennon is...
He just nails it.
It is extraordinary.
Yeah. And I mean, again, that is not an easy song to do live, those harmonies. And and Lennon in particular just dominates in a way that he doesn't. His personality is coming across in a way, and he's clearly having a ball as well. And you maybe do get a sense that perhaps in that initial show, he is the one that was conscious of how much was hanging on this. But by the time they get to the second show, it's a much more relaxed performance. It's a slightly looser.
Yes.
They know America is theirs.
Yes. They're proving themselves in the first one. For the second one, it's very much, it's us. And you know, it's us. And this is what we do. And again, you have to remind yourself that This Boy is an original song that is not particularly well known, that would have, you know, there's aspects of the song that are familiar, you know, in terms of, you know, kind of this kind of To Know Him Is To Love Him type vibe, or this kind of doo-woppy kind of type feel that underlies the whole song. But it is an unknown song. And as you say, it's hairs on the back of the neck when Lennon just steps forward and hits those notes in the middle of the song. And
it's the middle section, where he just kind of cuts loose. Yeah.
It's wonderful. And then for the second part, they do I Saw Her Standing There, From Me To You. And again, the number one song, I Want to Hold Your Hand, you know?
Yeah.
But it is a different vibe to the first one. You know, they have conquered and they are still number one, and they're heading towards that week when they're going to have the whole top five singles in the US charts. And in the audience, you have Joe Louis and Sonny Liston. It's very much a boxing town. There's a boxing match.
They get a kind of shout out. But there's a fight coming. There's a fight coming.
And the audience is much bigger than in the theater. And there's the story of the kid, isn't there, who somehow manages to get into the audience.
Yeah, there's a complete cock up in that the audience is 2,600 and CBS managed to give out 3,500 tickets. That's too many tickets. So there's like 800 or 900 people turn up that can't get in. But I find there's an eyewitness account. This is a 2019 edition of the Miami Herald that I just happen to have lying around the house. And it's a guy called Bob Saxon, who was 16 at the time. And he records the fact that, they'd kind of headed down to the hotel because they were going to meet the Beatles. And he said, there's no way to get in. And he said, there's thousands of people there. And they walked down a service road along the side of the hotel. There's a vacant catering truck. They get into the unlocked vehicle and then file out through its back doors. And they're in the hotel kitchen. And then one of the security people gets them. Sort of nabs them. And then this is where, you know, if this was happening to one of your children today, you'd be worried. he says, some guy wearing a bathrobe and a beach towel over his shoulder said, smoking a big cigar, came in from the pool and said, hey, you boys trying to meet the Beatles? The stranger told the sergeant we were with him. And he walked us past all the guests through the lobby into the auditorium and said, there you go, you're on your own from here. And they grabbed front row seats right beside the camera guys.
Amazing.
So you think, who is this guy, this benefactor? You know,
it's nice that it happened to fans. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah.
There's a sense already in that second show of, you know, people who think they're important latching onto the Beatles and wanting to get a bit of that luster. You know what I mean?
Well,
isn't there with the first show.
Exactly. So you say you've got in the show, you've got Sullivan is introducing Joe Louis and Sonny Liston in the audience. And it is a kind of, but this, these guys and 16 year old guys end up in the front row and they say, what happened was George kept opening the curtain and sticking his head out and all the girls would scream every time, every time. So they weren't interested in the boxers. They were interested in George.
So they travel back to the UK and they're back in the UK by the following weekend and on Sunday, the 23rd of February, they're actually doing a UK TV appearance with Mike and Bernie Winters. But Sunday, the 23rd of February is also the third Ed Sullivan appearance. And what this is a pre-recorded appearance that they recorded just before their original live performance on the 9th of February. So technically speaking, I know we're contradicting ourselves. George's first performance in the Ed Sullivan Theatre was actually for this pre-record for the February the 29th. And they've been contracted for the three appearances and assuming, we have to assume that, the third appearance could have been put at any point in the future, but Ed Sullivan just decided to make it 3 weeks in a row because they're the hot property. Who knows how long a phenomenon like this can last, really?
Well, exactly. I mean, this is the point at which everyone is thinking this is any pop group, is only going to have a limited run. So, he's making the most of it. And why not?
So that third Ed Sullivan show from the 23rd, if you watch it again now, Sullivan kind of alludes at the top of the show that the Beatles are pre-recorded. He kind of says, they're back in the UK, but they're with us tonight kind of thing. But if you weren't really maybe people weren't quite as media savvy in 64. It does, particularly at the end, there's a bit where he walks on and shares the stage with the Beatles. Yeah. You could assume that they're still live on the stage in New York.
They're still there. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that there's this chap called Ray Block, who is Sullivan's musical director. He wasn't impressed by their performance. And he said, I give them a year. Mm-hmm. The only thing that's different is the hair. So again, to hear somebody who's completely, has seen them do two shows, is completely tone deaf to what he has seen and the impact that's coming and saying, it'll all be over in a year.
Well, here's the thing. This is pre-recorded before their, All My Loving show on the 9th. And it's a pre-record, obviously, on tape. And here's one of my theories, because we talked about how on that, original performance on the 9th, John is a little bit laid back. But you watch this pre-record and it's actually very John. And I do wonder if, some people, looked at that and thought, that guy's a bit full on. Let's dial him down for the live show. Because this pre-record, which you have to imagine was recorded before the phenomenon had kicked in. It opens with John singing lead on Twist and Shout. And then he does Please Please Me. And he's pretty, live and upfront.
Yep.
And you kind of wonder, actually, if this had been what people had seen first on February the 9th, would it have had an impact? And it's a good performance, but I think no is the answer.
I think you're right. I think if the first thing people had seen was Twist and Shout, that's not going to do it. You could imagine that would be anticlimactic compared. We've had this build up. It's a great song. It's a great live song. It's a great live performance, but I Want to Hold Your Hand is the more sophisticated song. That's the start of the real kind of Beatlemania sound. All My Loving falls into that. It's a more sophisticated song. And you could see, I think that's a very good point that Twist and Shout is not representative.
Yeah.
And I don't think the impact would have been the same at all.
No. And it's again, one of the happy accents that All My Loving had the impact it had. This performance is a great performance, but it's certainly not as striking as the debut. It's even filmed in a much flatter way. And maybe that's to do with the fact that it's videotaped and it's being saved for another time. The whole show, that whole third show is quite odd. It has Morecambe and Wise on it, who are now obviously institutions over on this side of the Atlantic, mainly due to their 70s television programs for the BBC. They do not get laughs for their skit.
I find that very strange to watch that, and there being no laughter.
Yeah, and I did wonder.
You just sort of assume that if Morecambe Wise come on and do anything, people are going to laugh, and it's not an unfunny.
It's not unfunny
with these sort of glasses and breaking expensive glasses, but.
I'm not sure who wrote that sketch that they did on Ed Sullivan, because Eddie Braben is the writer who is credited with them turning into this other thing in the 1970s. Yeah. And what Eddie Braben did was he accentuated the personalities and the splits between Eric and Ernie. So Eric becomes the comedy one and Ernie becomes more of the straight man. Whereas you watch the Ed Sullivan one and they're both, it's still very talky, kind of American-y type sketch, you know?
And, I was watching it thinking they could have done that sketch in 1973. They could have reworked that sketch.
Yes. But it would have had more of Eric's kind of twitches and winks and laughs and that kind of stuff. Yes. And Eric is much more straight in it, which is odd.
Yes. But I just find it very odd to be watching something by Morgan and Wise that didn't have people laughing. And it's they're aware of it. You can see them. You can see the awareness behind their eyes that this is not going down well.
So it's a curious show, this one. There's also a lady singing a song about numbers, which is phenomenally lame. The out of all those first three shows, the only other thing that stuck out for me, apart from the Beatles, as being something quite extraordinary and out of time, is on that third show, Cab Calloway is on it. And I think he's extraordinary. I'm watching him going, oh my word, this is, and when Cab Calloway is on the Ed Sullivan show in 64, I looked it up. He was 56 years of age. He had, you know, Ed Sullivan refers to him coming through the Cotton Club, and Cab Calloway is extraordinary to watch.
That's very funny. We haven't talked about this, but that is the only other performance that I thought was worth tuning into. And I hadn't, until he suddenly appeared, until Sullivan suddenly, I wasn't sort of aware or conscious that he was on the show.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, this is somebody from another era.
Yeah.
But yet his performance is the kind of second most compelling thing on that show. It's an incredible performance.
It's an incredible performance. And you think of the arc of his career, and this isn't the Cab Calloway podcast, but you know, he then goes on to
do a Cab Calloway podcast.
The kids want it. But like, you think he goes on to appear in the Blues Brothers. When I was a kid, he was in adverts for hula hoop snacks on British television. Yeah. He had a long and amazing career. And
can I make a confession here?
Go on.
I have never seen the Blues Brothers.
You know what? It's one of those movies that even if you haven't seen it, you kind of have seen it. You probably know exactly what it's about.
I kind of know what it's about.
Yeah.
And I have seen, but I just, can I also make another confession and say I don't like Dan Aykroyd?
Oh, okay. Not even his appearance in the Spies Like Us video. Paul's last top 10 hit.
That's obviously the highlight of his entire career. No, I just never got it. I just never got it. Sorry, we've lost that.
Here we go. Off on a tangent. The show ends. This third appearance appears again. It's a pre-record with "I Want to Hold Your Hand." Paul's mic seems to take over on this again, and Paul's voice seems to dominate. So maybe this is the start where they're switching the mics around for the live performance. You know?
Yeah. Well, did you notice there's that one performance where John's mic keeps falling?
Yes, and he keeps topping it back up,
and he has to keep moving. So you think Paul's been out with a little screwdriver and loosening it up before the performance, you know.
But what's you know, you kind of think that, you know, other bands would have been, you know, let's get a Paul one, let's get a John one, let's divvy it up, but they were such a unit, it just didn't matter.
Didn't seem to matter,
and that's the good thing. So that's the third appearance in 3 weeks, and they're back in the UK, and basically their appearance on the Ed Sullivan show has done its job. But there is a bit of an afterlife that we need to talk about. There's one or two other kind of postscripts to all of this. There is a fourth appearance of the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan show in 1963. On the 26th of May, there's a filmed insert shown where they're being interviewed by Ed Sullivan in London at the end of the Hard Day's Night shoot. And it's a brief 2-minute piece. You can see it on YouTube. But they are talking about, you know, they filmed the movie and they're coming back to do their big tour, their 25-day tour in the US in August 1964. And we kind of think sometimes you conflate the first big US tour with the Ed Sullivan show, but they only do those two dates around the Ed Sullivan time. And actually the big tour is in August 64, you know? So they do have that kind of fourth filmed appearance on the Ed Sullivan show. But something that is totally forgotten about is the Beatles' fourth appearance in person on the Ed Sullivan show, which they record on the 14th of August, 1965, and which is broadcast not live, but it goes out a month later on September the 12th, 1965, which is a hugely successful performance. But when you watch that fourth appearance 18 months later, they are changed and the world has changed.
It's a different band.
Yeah. It's very different.
Yeah, they look different. They sound different. The way they're being presented is different. As you say, they're completely in charge now. They're dominating everything. And, yeah. But it's in a way, it's almost more fascinating to watch. We're kind of so perhaps overly familiar with that All My Loving.
Yeah. Punch. Well, it's totally forgotten, this kind of performance, I think,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like they are, you know, this is kind of post Help. And it's essentially the last time that they kind of do a batch of television, because they do the same kind of set for Big Night Out over in Blackpool on ITV at the same time. And what I noticed is when you watch these shows, and I said, they're on DVD and you can watch the whole shows, you know, the whole unit with inbuilt advertisements and all the rest. That show four is very different. You kind of realize, oh, we're living in a Beatles world now. Even the first advert that they have in that show four, which is for Lipton's tea, is kind of wacky and fab. And there's a guy driving a boat out of a lake. And it's not like here's a housewife in a kitchen type advert. It's very much, you know, oh, it's all fab and youthful and all the rest. And, you know, Cilla Black is also on the show. So what you also notice is that obviously Brian Epstein has power here to say, oh, you want the Beatles? Well, you're going to take Cilla as well. How about that?
Yeah, I can understand from that performance, though, why Cilla didn't
take off.
You know, it's a very kind of flat.
What is interesting about Cilla is, like, she's 22 and she's ferociously confident. Like she's very, they're not the best song choices, I agree.
No.
But she's laid back and she's, you know, she's not.
Yeah, you're saying that how young she is, but they've kind of dressed her and styled her hair in and given her song choices, which are from a previous era.
Yes.
You know, it's harking back to. So again, it's this idea, you know, we go right back to Epstein bringing Billy J. Kramer to New York and saying, right, well, you're going to be a cabaret star. I mean, you know, he's where do you pitch Cilla Black?
Yeah.
And, you know, she's being pitched, I suppose, where she eventually ended up. You know, she was that kind of middle of the road kind of torch singer. And then she had her own TV show in the UK and she becomes a bit of an institution in that regard. But, you know, there's nothing there. You think there's nothing that she's doing on this show that the Americans aren't already doing themselves.
So you watch this show and the Beatles come out. They get called out individually, actually, in the order of John, George, Paul and Ringo, where, you know, Ed kind of shakes their hand and the audience goes crazy. They look cool. John Lennon in particular looks extraordinarily cool.
John in this John is just the coolest man on earth at this point. And the camera angles they put on him when he's singing, which are kind of slightly upwards. Low down and upwards, are just accentuate the kind of the cheekbones, the nose. He looks phenomenal.
He does look phenomenal. And again, as you say, camera angles and all that, there is a pop aesthetic that is creeping into Ed Sullivan that the Beatles have been driving in the culture, which is interesting. They open up with I Feel Fine, and you watching I Feel Fine, and it's a masterclass in Ringo, because you just see him, you know, riding that ride cymbal, his drumming on that, you could just watch him play that crazy kind of samba beat of I Feel Fine, and they're super. And it's worth reminding yourselves in chronology that this is being recorded about two or three days before the Shea Stadium appearance. This is the same week, which means that the next song they sing, which is I'm Down, you know, Lennon is on the Vox Continental organ, which we kind of know from the Shea Stadium performance, which is always a fun thing to see, always an odd thing to see. And usually it's Lennon messing up the lyrics, but Paul messes up the lyrics to I'm Down, where he sings the second verse first and the first verse second, and they all kind of acknowledge it. And, you know, he starts the song by saying, man buys ring, woman throws it away, which is always confusing. And then the third song they do, singing his first ever vocal on Ed Sullivan, is Ringo. And Ringo does that great introduction.
your favorite song.
But he introduces himself. He says, and now all nervous and out of tune, it's Ringo. Yeah. And off he goes into Act Naturally. And, it's
charming.
Totally charming. And it's interesting that even in 65, when they're totally cool, Help, the movie is about to hit the screens, you know, Ringo is still there doing Act Naturally. There's still that tiny little bit of let's entertain everybody there, you know?
Yeah. And it's that very self-deprecating introduction is just
perfect. Perfect. It's an odd selection of people on the show. Alan and Rossi are this comedy act who are like a terrible version of Martin and Lewis. And, you know, this crazy guy runs on and they're constantly referencing the Beatles, trying to get the audience to react. Yeah. I'm Ringo's wife. And they run up and down the aisle singing these Beatles spoof lyrics and all the rest. It's just terrible. And then Soupy Sales is on singing a song about the mouse. Oh. And he runs up and down the audience as well. And you get a really good view of the theatre, which is the theatre that, you know, you
Soupy
can recognize.
Sales. I never thought Soupy Sales. I didn't think that was actually a real thing. A real person.
You're kind of watching Soupy Sales. He's Soupy Sales. I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe if any listeners out there were watching this contemporaneously, can you tell me whether this was entertaining or whether it was obviously lame at the time? It seemed lame to me.
Are we just jaded by 21st century
entertainment? Possibly. Entertainment. But then the Beatles come on at the end to do three more songs, and they start with Ticket to Ride. And that what's interesting about that is they keep the intro just keeps going on and on and on. Lennon doesn't seem to know when to come in.
Yeah.
And then Paul does Yesterday solo. So again, this is kind of similar, as we said, in timeline to the big Blackpool Big Night Out performance. Yeah. And Paul is on his own. Yesterday hasn't really dropped yet. And it's always interesting to see how Yesterday is highlighted right up front as an important big song. And yes, Paul is on his own.
Yeah, they know this. What I would say is Paul doesn't look great. Lennon talks about this being his fat Elvis period, this kind of 65. But he looks great. It's Paul is kind of even more doe-eyed than usual. I don't think and the makeup that they have put on all of them is terrible. It's they're very made up, and the lighting, it's not good. The only one of the four of them that comes out well looking well, I think, is John.
I mean, Paul subsequently talked in interviews about how nervous he was waiting behind the curtains to go out and perform on Ed Sullivan, and how, you know, the people pulling back the curtains are like, hey, there's 70 million people viewing there. You better be worried. And when you watch it back, you're like, there are no curtains. He just goes from singing Ticket to Ride to singing Yesterday. Yes. I don't know what he's remembering or what he's talking about. But John comes back on at the end and says, thank you, Paul. That was just like him, which is always fun. And then they end with Help.
Yes.
And what you notice from those three songs, Ticket to Ride, Yesterday and Help, is they are much more ramshackle than All My Loving. And you get the sense that they are outgrowing it all, that these are songs that are tilting towards studio work than live work, that they don't really lend themselves to rocking up as a four-piece to a TV studio to play at all.
Yes, that's right. You tend to think of 1966 as being the point at which the studio takes over and live performance starts to suffer. But yeah, there's absolutely the sense that these are studio songs, and ramshackle is probably the word.
Yeah. So they are the four main studio performances of the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. Did they make a difference in their lives? Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah. What would their outcome have been if they hadn't done those shows? Well, they were already number one before the Ed Sullivan Show. So what would have happened, I wonder?
Well, I mean, you think that the number of people, Dan Aykroyd included, who says, oh, I remember that night. I remember that Sunday night. And it seems to have just been such a huge impact that, you know, it's one thing to have a number one single, but it's quite another to be kind of beamed live into 70 million or into 20 million houses and 70 million people to be watching you. You don't get that kind of exposure from a number one single, you know, no matter how many kind of appearances you do on Dick Clark's Bandstand or whatever. And it's the fact that Ed Sullivan was a show that was going to be watched by everyone. It was a variety show. It had something for the kids. It had something for the mums and dads. And the Beatles are just front and center.
Yeah.
On three across that first run, three shows.
It is. It's definitely worth checking out the DVD. I'm not sure whether it's out of print at the minute, but the four complete shows are available on a double DVD. And it's. I said it's really interesting to see all of the performances in context. There is a bit of a tale of more Ed Sullivan work that we should just mention as we head out here, which is, you know, they would constantly, you know, send out telegrams and video clips and news and things. You know, there's you can go onto YouTube and look at all these kind of different references. But, you know, some of the films that they recorded for Paperback Writer and Rain and Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever, they all get shown on Ed Sullivan, don't they?
Yes. I mean, they to, you know, the one thing you would say is they do seem to be aware of how important Ed Sullivan was to them. And, it, you know, they don't kind of run off to another show, or they don't run off to other media outlets. So they stick with it. So as you say, they are sending telegrams. He is reading out little telegrams on air. And this goes all the way up to first day of March 1970, when he airs clips of Two of Us and Let It Be ahead of the film coming out. So they are, if you like, constantly paying that debt back.
Yes. And you even watch Sullivan presenting those clips in March 1970. And, you know, I know we've talked about it an awful lot before, but you could easily have watched those clips in March 1970 and think the Beatles were still together. They're still going. He kind of introduced them as, look, here's just the next thing from the Beatles. Here's the Let It Be song.
Yes.
Away we go. One of the nice things that to dig out was that, they send them, you know, at the end of 1967, when obviously the Beatles are teeing up Magical Mystery Tour and all the rest, Ed Sullivan reads out a telegram from them. That's a very cheery mop top style telegram wishing him well, because the Studio 50 is being renamed the Ed Sullivan Theatre and he's been on the air for 20 seasons and all the rest. And it's, you know, it's just a very, you know, mannerly. And even in that 1967 clip, Ed Sullivan is constantly talking about how well-mannered and how well brought up the Beatles were. It's really, there's one clip of him where he's reading one of these telegrams and he says, you know, they come from Liverpool, and Liverpool has people from Ireland and Wales and Scotland and all that live there, and they all bring up their children right, and the Beatles were brought up right, and they're very well-mannered, and they're it's quite funny.
You can't deny it. You can't deny it.
And it's true. It can confirm.
It's interesting the fact that Sullivan, you know, there is that relationship, I think, between the Beatles and Sullivan. You know, he is still supporting them right up to 1970. They are supporting him. They are aware of the debt. And for all that he references the Beatles, you don't get a sense that he's kind of milking it or he's over egging. He's not over playing his part. I mean, if anything, you know, if I were in that position of being the man that had introduced the Beatles to America, you know, I never stopped talking about it on every chat show. And although they had that number one single, I have some statistics here that kind of follow on from Sullivan. So the first album, the first Capitol album, Meet the Beatles, it gets the number one on Billboard on the 15th of February. So the day before the Sullivan show, stays at number one for 11 weeks. It's in the charts for 74 weeks. On the 22nd of February, they go back to the UK. And we talked about there being 4,000 fans when they left. There's 10,000 fans are there to greet them when they come back, because their American success is being reported back home, because it's such an extraordinary thing. No British act has kind of done that. In the 9 days that they were in America, 2 million Beatles records were sold in that 9 day period. And it's a $2.5 million worth of Beatles related goods.
That's amazing.
You know, so sort of memorabilia. By April the 4th, this is, I'm going to ask you the question. By April the 4th, the Beatles held the top 5 single positions in the charts, as well as how many other positions in the Billboard charts? This is the question that got us the podcast.
This was, isn't it 12?
Yes.
Hey.
and then 2nd of May, the second album comes out. So
amazing.
Between May and February. So all of this, you know, they were going to get there, but this accelerated everything.
The final thing to talk about is that, you know, not many TV appearances generate their own 50th anniversary Grammy special.
Yes.
And so we should probably end by talking that in February 2014, a TV special called The Night That Changed America, A Grammy Salute to the Beatles, was recorded and broadcast celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Beatles appearing on The Ed Sullivan Show. And this is why, you know, going back to when we started talking about this, you know, you know, Ed Sullivan gets remembered more for the Beatles than anything else.
Yes. And, I mean, it's like in 74 when Capitol did their 10-year anniversary. It's 10 years. It's the Sullivan Show. It's 64 is year zero for America.
Yes. And that TV special, The Night That Changed America, is very, it seems like a really difficult place, because the Beatles as an entity, you know, they're very protective of their legacy, and they're having to step into a Grammy event where Paul and Ringo are together. It's very odd. Paul is never comfortable. Ringo is quite happy. Paul is not comfortable.
There isn't. Ringo's comfortable anywhere, I think. You know, Ringo is Ringo. But it's not a comfortable interaction between the two of them. It's almost they're sort of reduced to the level of bit players or something, or they're kind of performing fleas. It's not like them. It's not a natural performance.
And it opens with Ed Sheeran. Oh, God. Maroon 5. Oh, dear. Stevie Wonder is fantastic. He does We Can Work It Out. That cheers everyone up. And then Ringo does Matchbox, and Yoko's in the audience dancing. It's very strange.
That is slightly surreal.
What I noticed kind of scanning through it again for this is that, you know, Paul's band are great. They come on, they do a few songs, and you realize Paul's band, it's not easy to cover a Beatles song sometimes. All these other bands are kind of half-assing it, and Paul's band come on, and they're just
They've been doing it for years.
That is true.
I think I saw them in 2002 was the first time I saw that band.
And it is, the most interesting bit is that Letterman does reappear, and he walks McCartney and Ringo around the Ed Sullivan Theatre for a specially shot piece, asking them about what they remember. And the answer is they don't really remember much.
No,
they're just like, maybe we were here, maybe we weren't there. Yeah. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
But he does ask them one good question, which, you know, he asks Ringo, who put together the playlist for the Ed Sullivan Show? Like, who decided what songs you were going to sing? And Ringo is quite engaged in this. And he's like, well, we're not really sure. We just, you know, he seems to seem as just a casual decision. Whereas, you know, for part of the interview, Paul trots out, oh, the Beatles are a great little band. And Ringo just laughs in Paul's face. It's brilliant. He's like, shut up. What are you on about? You know?
It is that sense that, you know, all of the Beatles have had set responses.
Yeah.
But Ringo is the one that you're much more likely to get an honest response from.
Yes.
And he's still, I think, for all that Paul talks about, we were a great little band, Ringo is still their biggest fan.
Absolutely. I know, you absolutely see it there, you know.
And slightly mystified as to how it happened and how he ended up where he is.
That it happened.
I'm grateful for it, yeah.
The other, you know, the whole 50th anniversary of Ed Sullivan also, CBS were pushing the angle that it got broadcast on CBS. Letterman is a CBS broadcaster. And there was also a CBS roundtable discussion from the floor of the Ed Sullivan Theatre, which had the oddest collection of guests, which I'm just going to read out here, which was Mick Jones from Foreigner, John Oates from Hall and, Andrew Oldham, Nile Rodgers, Julie Taymor, Patty Boyd, and good old Neil Innes, all sitting on the stage of the Ed Sullivan Theatre being interviewed about what it all means, you know?
And no Mitzi Gaynor. They missed the trick.
They should have got Mitzi Gaynor, but they should have had a special on the following week from Miami.
Done. They should have had people who were there, other artists on the show. Maybe all those other artists would be going, oh, it was the worst night of my life because they wiped the floor with us and no one was interested.
But we're still living with the ramifications of the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. So the Ed Sullivan Theatre is now the home of Stephen Colbert's Late Show. And in 2019, to introduce the South Korean K-pop band BTS to America for their first live television appearance, they dressed up as the Beatles. Colbert dressed up as Ed Sullivan because BTS is in the word Beatles. They even used the logo. They used the monogram. And the executive producer of Colbert at the time said, you know, many musical guests come on the show and they want to ape the Beatles and we won't let them. But we allowed BTS to do it because there were parallels of a foreign band being introduced to an American audience. And so the entire BTS performance is in black and white, in Beatles suits, doing their thing. I won't hear a word against BTS. They're very good.
I heard lots of words there. that I know what those words mean individually, but when you put them together in that order, I wasn't entirely clear. But I'll find a 13-year-old.
We'll stick up some links to the BTS on Stephen Colbert, but all roads lead back to the seismic performance of the Beatles on Ed Sullivan back in 1964. But what do you think, folks? How many listeners out there saw it go out live? We'd love to talk to you in all the usual places. We're on Twitter at Beatles Pod. We've the Nothing Is Real Facebook group. And now we have nothingisrealpod.com, which is your gateway to all things Nothing Is Real. We have all our playlists up there. We've got YouTube links up there. We're going to put some exclusive content up there as well. And there's other ways to get in touch and support the podcast. All available on nothingisrealpod.com.
I'm really interested to see if there's anyone gets in touch that has seen that. I'm really looking forward to Dan Aykroyd getting in touch.
I'd say Dan Aykroyd would have some stories if he does want to come on the podcast.
I have said Dan Aykroyd would like to come on the podcast. I'm prepared to watch the Blues Brothers before he gets here.
That seems like a fair trade. Let us know what you think, folks. And again, hopefully we'll drive you back to some crazy YouTube clips and to listening to all that music all over again. But as usual, thanks for listening. My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. See you next time.